This is Audible.
Books on Tape presents Under the Banner of Heaven, A Story of Violent Faith by John Krakauer, read by Scott Brick. We believe in honesty, morality, and purity. But when they enact tyrannical laws forbidding us the free exercise of our religion, we cannot submit. God is greater than the United States, and when the government conflicts with heaven, we will be ranged under the banner of heaven and against the government. Polygamy is a divine institution. It has been handed down direct from God. The United States cannot abolish it. No nation on earth can prevent it, nor all the nations of the earth combined. I defy the United States. I will obey God. John Taylor, on January 4th, 1880, President, Prophet, Seer, and Revelator, Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. No Western nation is as religion-soaked as ours, where 9 out of 10 of us love God and are loved by Him in return. That mutual passion centers our society and demands some understanding, if our doom-eager society is to be understood at all. Harold Bloom, The American Religion. Prologue. Almost everyone in Utah County has heard of the Lafferty Boys. That's mostly a function of the lurid murders, of course, but the Lafferty surname had a certain prominence in the county even before Brenda and Erica Lafferty were killed. Watson Lafferty, the patriarch of the clan, was a chiropractor who ran a thriving practice out of his home in downtown Provo's historic quarter. He and his wife Claudine had 6 boys and 2 girls, in whom they instilled an unusually strong work ethic and intense devotion to the Mormon Church. The entire family was admired for their industriousness and probity. Alan, the youngest of the Lafferty children, now in his mid-40s, works as a tile setter, a trade he has plied since he was a teenager. In the summer of 1984, he was living with his 24-year-old wife and baby daughter in American Fork, a sleepy, white-bread suburb alongside the freeway that runs from Provo to Salt Lake City. Brenda, his spouse, was a one-time beauty queen recognized around town from her tenure as the anchor of a news magazine program on Channel 11, the local PBS affiliate. Although she had abandoned her nascent broadcasting career to marry Alan and start a family, Brenda had lost none of the exuberance that had endeared her to television viewers. Warm and outgoing, she'd made a lasting impression. On the morning of July 24th, 1984, Alan left their small duplex apartment before the sun was up and drove 80 miles up the interstate to work at a construction site east of Ogden. During his lunch break, he phoned Brenda, who chatted with him for a minute before putting their 15-month-old daughter Erica on the line. Erica gurgled a few words of baby talk. Then Brenda told her husband everything was fine and said goodbye. Alan arrived home around 8 that evening, tired from the long workday. He walked up to the front door and was surprised to find it locked. They almost never locked their doors. He used his key to enter and then was surprised again by the baseball game blaring from the television in the living room. Neither he nor Brenda liked baseball. They never watched it. After he'd turned off the TV, the apartment seemed preternaturally quiet to him, as though nobody was home. Alan figured Brenda had taken the baby and gone out. "I turned to go and see if maybe she was at the neighbor's," he explained later, "and I noticed some blood near the door on a light switch." And then he saw Brenda in the kitchen, sprawled on the floor in a lake of blood. Upon calling Brenda's name and getting no reply, he knelt beside her and put his hand on her shoulder. "I touched her," he said, "and her body felt cool. There was blood on her face and pretty much everywhere." Alan reached for the kitchen phone, which was resting on the floor next to his wife, and dialed 911 before he realized there was no dial tone. The cord had been yanked from the wall. As he walked to their bedroom to try the extension in there, he glanced into the baby's room and saw Erica slumped over in her crib in an odd position, motionless. She was wearing nothing but a diaper which was soaked with blood, as were the blankets surrounding her. Alan hurried to the master bedroom only to find the phone in there out of order as well, so he went next door to a neighbor's apartment where he was finally able to call for help. He described the carnage to the 911 dispatcher, then called his mother. While he waited for the police to show up, Alan returned to his apartment. I went to Brenda and I prayed, he said. And then as I stood, I surveyed the situation a little more and realized that there had been a grim struggle. For the first time, he noticed that the blood wasn't confined to the kitchen. It smeared the living room walls, the floor, the doors, the curtains. It was obvious to him who was responsible. He'd known the moment he'd first seen Brenda on the kitchen floor. The cops took Alan down to the American Fork police station and grilled him throughout the night. They assumed he was the murderer, the husband usually is. By and by, however, Alan convinced them that the prime suspect was actually the oldest of his five brothers, Ron Lafferty. Ron had just returned to Utah County after spending most of the previous 3 months traveling around the West with another Lafferty brother, Dan. An APB went out for Ron's car, a pale green 1974 Impala station wagon with Utah plates. The slayings appeared to be ritualistic, which drew uncommon attention from the news media and put the public on edge. By the next evening, the Lafferty killings led news broadcasts across the state. On Thursday, July 26th, the headline on the front page of the Salt Lake Tribune announced, "Widespread search underway for American Fork murder suspect," by Mike Gorell, Tribune staff writer, and Ann Shields, Tribune correspondent. American Fork. Lawmen in Utah and surrounding states searched Wednesday for a former Highland, Utah County, city councilman and religious fundamentalist charged with the Tuesday murders of his sister-in-law and her 15-month-old baby. Ronald Watson Lafferty, 42, no address available, was charged with two counts of capital homicide in the deaths of Brenda Wright Lafferty, 24, and her daughter, Erica Lane. American Fork police have not established a motive for the killings and have refused to comment on rumors that the suspect, an excommunicated member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, was involved with either polygamist or fundamentalist religious sects, and that those ties may have contributed to the killings. Neighbors expressed disbelief that this sort of thing could happen in their area. The whole town's in shock that such a thing could happen in a nice, quiet community like American Fork. People who said they had never locked their doors said they were going to now, said one neighbor who asked not to be identified. Ken Beck, a bishop in the American Fork LDS ward which Alan and Brenda Lafferty attended, said they were a nice, ordinary couple, active in church affairs. Immediately below this story, also on the front page, was an accompanying piece. Neighbors recall changes in murder suspect, 42, special to the Tribune. American Fork. A determined man who evolved from an active Mormon and conservative Republican to a strict constitutionalist and excommunicated fundamentalist is how neighbors remember Ronald Watson Lafferty. Mr. Lafferty served on Highland's first city council when the small northern Utah county town was incorporated in 1977. At the time, Mr. Lafferty successfully led a drive to outlaw beer sales in the town's only grocery store, where travelers to American Fork Canyon still can't buy beer. 2 years ago, he looked clean, all-American, even in the mornings after milking the family cow, said a neighbor who resides in an acre-lot subdivision filled with children, horses, goats, chickens, and large garden plots where Mr. Lafferty once lived. Last year, he and his wife of several years divorced. Mr. Lafferty has not been seen in the neighborhood for a year. Shortly after Christmas, Mrs. Diana Lafferty, described as a pillar of the Mormon ward, took the couple's six children out of state. Neighbors said the divorce stemmed from differences of opinion on religion and politics. He talked about standing up for what was right, no matter the consequences, said a neighbor. Friends said Mr. Lafferty's political beliefs changed as well, or perhaps evolved, from conservative Republican to strict fundamentalism. During the 12 years he lived in Highland, he came to believe in a return to the gold standard, strict constitutionalism and obedience only to righteous laws, said a neighbor. He had a fervent desire to save the Constitution and the country, said a longtime friend. It became a religious obsession. Detectives interviewed as many of Alan's siblings as they could locate, as well as his mother and various friends. As the front page of Saturday's Tribune revealed, the cops were beginning to piece together a motive for the brutal acts. Two murders, a religious revelation? Three charged in slashing of mother and infant, by Ann Shields, Tribune correspondent. American Fork. two more men Friday were charged with first-degree murder in connection with the July 24th slaying of an American Fork woman and her 15-month-old daughter, as police disclosed that the killings may have been part of a religious revelation. Charged Friday with capital homicide were Dan Lafferty, age unavailable, Salem, a former candidate for Utah County Sheriff and the victim's brother-in-law, and Richard M. Knapp, 24, formerly of Wichita, Kansas. Dan Lafferty's brother, Ronald Lafferty, 42, Highland, Utah County, was charged Wednesday with two counts of first-degree murder. Police Chief Randy Johnson revealed Friday that the investigation into the murders has caused police to believe that Ron had a handwritten revelation which told him to commit this crime. If this document does exist, it is a vital piece of evidence, and we would like to see it. He asked anyone with information regarding the document to contact the American Force Police Department or the FBI. Chief Johnson said the men are believed to be armed and should be considered dangerous, particularly to law enforcement officials. Neighbors and friends of the suspects and victims noted that Ron Lafferty apparently was affiliated or had founded a polygamist or fundamentalist religious sect, causing speculation that the crimes may have resulted from a religious argument in the family. On July 30th, Ron's run-down Impala was spotted parked in front of a house in Cheyenne, Wyoming. When they raided the home, police didn't find the Lafferty brothers, but they did arrest Richard, Ricky, Knapp, and Chip Carnes, two drifters who had been traveling around the West with the Laffertys since early summer. Information provided by Knapp and Carnes led authorities to Reno, Nevada, where on August 7th the police arrested Ron and Dan as they stood in line for the buffet at the Circus Casino. From jail, before their trial, the brothers launched an unpersuasive media campaign protesting their innocence. Ron insisted that the charges against them were false and that the Mormon Church, which controlled everything in Utah, would prevent his brother and him from receiving a fair trial. Although he confessed to believing in the righteousness of plural marriage, Ron said he had never practiced polygamy or belonged to an extremist sect. He then professed to love the Mormon Church, while at the same time warning that the current LDS leadership had strayed from the sacred doctrines of the religion's founding prophet, Joseph Smith. 4 days later, Dan Lafferty issued a written statement to the media in which he declared that he and Ron were not guilty of any of the crimes for which we've been accused, adding that the time is at hand when the true criminals will be made known. On December 29th, 5 days before their trial was scheduled to begin in Provo, Lieutenant Jerry Scott, the commander of the Utah County Jail, took Dan from his cell to ask him some questions. When Dan returned, he found his older brother suspended by his neck from a towel rack in an adjacent cell, unconscious and no longer breathing. Ron had used a T-shirt to hang himself. "I pushed the intercom button and told them they'd better get down there," Dan says. Lieutenant Scott arrived immediately but could detect no pulse in Ron. Although Scott and two other deputies administered mouth-to-mouth resuscitation and CPR, they were unable to revive him. "By the time paramedics showed up," said Scott, "the inmate appeared dead." Despite the fact that Ron had stopped breathing for an estimated 15 minutes, the paramedics eventually managed to get his heart beating again, and he was placed on a respirator in the intensive care unit of the Utah Valley Regional Medical Center. After remaining comatose for 2 days, he regained consciousness, an astonishing recovery that Dan attributes to divine intervention. Although the brothers were slated to be tried together 3 days after Ron emerged from his coma, Judge J. Robert Bullock ordered that Dan should be tried alone, as scheduled, allowing Ron time to recover and undergo extensive psychiatric evaluation to determine if he'd suffered brain damage. The court appointed two attorneys to represent Dan, but he insisted on defending himself, relegating them to advisory roles. 5 days after the trial began, the jury went into deliberation and 9 hours later found Dan guilty of two counts of first-degree murder. During the subsequent session to determine whether Dan should be put to death for his crimes, Dan assured the jurors, "If I was in your situation, I would impose the death penalty," and promised not to appeal if they arrived at such a sentence. "The judge freaked out when I said that," Dan later explained. "He thought I was expressing a death wish and warned the jury that they couldn't vote to execute me just because I had a death wish. But I just wanted them to feel free to follow their conscience. I didn't want them to worry or feel guilty about giving me a death sentence if that's what they thought I deserved. I was willing to take a life for God, so it seemed to me that I should also be willing to give my own life for God. If God wanted me to be executed, I was fine with that. 10 jurors voted for death, but 2 others refused to go along with the majority. Because unanimity was required to impose a capital sentence, Dan's life was spared. According to the jury foreman, one of the jurors who balked at executing Dan was a woman whom he had manipulated through eye contact, smiles, and other charismatic nonverbal attachments and psychosexual seduction, causing her to ignore both the evidence and the instructions provided by the judge. The foreman, aghast that Dan had thereby avoided a death sentence, was furious. Dan says that he, too, was a little disappointed that I wasn't executed, in a strange sense. Addressing the convicted prisoner with undisguised scorn, Judge Bullock reminded Dan that it was man's law, which you disdain, that saved your life. Then, his disgust getting the better of him, he added, "In my 12 years as a judge, I have never presided over a trial of such a cruel, heinous, pointless, and senseless a crime as the murders of Brenda and Erica Lafferty. Nor have I seen an accused who had so little remorse or feeling." This admonishment came from the same hardened judge who, in 1976, had presided over the notorious, history-making trial of Gary Mark Gilmore for the unprovoked murders of 2 young Mormons. The first convict to be executed in the United States in more than a decade, Gary Gilmore came to symbolize America's renewed embracing of capital punishment in the 1970s. His story has been memorably told by his brother, Michael Gilmore, in Shot in the Heart, and by Norman Mailer in his Pulitzer Prize-winning work, The Executioner's Song. The Gilmore and Lafferty trials happened to share a number of protagonists, in addition to Judge J. Robert Bullock. One of Gary Gilmore's court-appointed lawyers was Mike Esplin, who was later assigned to represent Ron and Dan Lafferty in their murder trials. And Utah County Attorney Noel T. Wooten prosecuted Gilmore as well as both Lafferty brothers. After telling the 1985 court that the jury had been unable to agree on a sentence of death, Judge Bullock turned to Dan and said, "I mean to see that every minute of your life is spent behind the bars of the Utah State Prison, and I so order." He sentenced Dan to 2 life terms. Ron's trial began almost 4 months later in April 1985, after a battery of psychiatrists and psychologists had determined that he was mentally competent. His court-appointed attorneys hoped to get the murder charges reduced to manslaughter by arguing that Ron was suffering from mental illness when he and Dan murdered Brenda Lafferty and her baby. But Ron refused to allow them to mount such a defense. "It seems it would be an admission of guilt," he told Judge Bullock. "I'm not prepared to do that." Ron was convicted of first-degree murder, and on this occasion the jury did not balk at imposing capital punishment. They sentenced him to die either by lethal injection or 4 bullets through the heart at close range. Ron chose the latter. On January 15, 1985, immediately after Judge Bullock decreed that the remainder of Dan Lafferty's life would unfold in captivity, he was taken to the state prison at Point of the Mountain near Draper, Utah, where a corrections officer cut his hair and sheared off his whiskers. That was nearly 17 years ago, and Dan hasn't shaved or cut his hair since. His beard, wrapped with rubber bands into a stiff gray cable, now descends to his belly. His hair has gone white and fans across the back of his orange prison jumpsuit. Although he is 54 years old and crow's feet furrow the corners of his eyes, there is something unmistakably boyish about his countenance. His skin is so pale it seems translucent. A crude tattoo of a spiderweb radiates from Dan's left elbow, wrapping the crook of his arm in a jagged indigo lattice. His wrists are bound in handcuffs, and his shackled ankles are chained to a steel ring embedded in the concrete floor. On his otherwise bare feet are cheap rubber flip-flops. A large man, he cheerfully refers to the prison's maximum security unit as "my monastery." Every morning a wake-up alarm echoes through the halls of the unit at 6:30, followed by a head count. The door to his cell remains locked 20 hours a day. "Even when it isn't locked," Dan says, "I'm almost always in my cell. The only time I leave is to shower or serve food. I have a job serving meals. But I don't really associate with people that much. I try not to leave my cell more often than I absolutely have to. There are so many assholes in here. They get you caught up in their little dramas and you end up having to fuck somebody up. And the next thing you know, your privileges are taken away. I've got too much to lose. I'm in a really comfortable situation right now. I've got a really good cellie, and I don't want to lose him. That cellie, or cellmate, is Mark Hoffman, a once-devout Mormon who lost his faith while serving as a missionary in England and secretly became an atheist, although he continued to present himself as an exemplary Latter-day Saint when he returned to Utah. Soon thereafter, Hoffman discovered that he had a special talent for forgery. He began to churn out bogus historical documents, brilliantly rendered, which fetched large sums from collectors. In October 1985, upon concluding that investigators were about to discover that several old Mormon documents he'd sold were fakes, he detonated a series of pipe bombs to divert detectives from his trail, killing two guiltless fellow saints in the process. Mark Hoffman's criminal activities have been deftly recounted in A Gathering of Saints by Robert Lindsay and Salamander by Linda Sillitoe and Alan Roberts. Many of Hoffman's forgeries were intended to discredit Joseph Smith and the sacred history of Mormonism. More than 400 of these fraudulent artifacts were purchased by the LDS Church, which believed they were authentic, then squirreled away in a vault to keep them from the public eye. Although Hoffman now expresses contempt for religion in general and Mormonism in particular, his atheism doesn't seem to be an issue in his friendship with Dan Lafferty. Despite the fact that Dan remains, by his own proud characterization, a religious zealot. "My beliefs are irrelevant to my cellie," Dan confirms. "We're special brothers all the same. We're bound by the heart." Prior to Dan's conviction and for more than a decade afterward, he steadfastly maintained that he was innocent of the murders of Brenda and Erica Lafferty. When he was arrested in Reno in August 1984, he told the arresting officers, "You think I have committed a crime of homicide, but I have not." He still insists that he is innocent of any crime, but paradoxically, does not deny that he killed Brenda and Erica. When asked to explain how both of these apparently contradictory statements can be true, he says, "I was doing God's will, which is not a crime." Lafferty isn't reticent about describing exactly what happened on July 24, 1984. He says that shortly after noon, he, Ron, and the two drifters who had been traveling with them, Ricky Knapp and Chip Carnes, drove to the apartment of his youngest brother, Alan, in American Fork, 20 minutes down the interstate from where he is now imprisoned. Inside the brick duplex, he found his 15-month-old niece, Erica, standing in her crib, smiling up at him. "I spoke to her for a minute," Lafferty recalls. "I told her, 'I'm not sure what this is all about, but apparently it's God's will that you leave this world. Perhaps we can talk about it later.'" And then he ended her life with a 10-inch boning knife. After dispatching Erica, he calmly walked into the kitchen and used the same knife to kill the baby's mother. Now, 17 years after committing these two murders, he insists very convincingly that he has never felt any regret for the deed or shame. Like his older brother Ron, Dan Lafferty was brought up as a pious Mormon. "I've always been interested in God and the kingdom of God," he says. "It's been the center of my focus since I was a young child." And he is certain God intended for him to kill Brenda and Erica Lafferty. "It was like someone had taken me by the hand that day and led me comfortably through everything that happened. Ron had received a revelation from God that these lives were to be taken. I was the one who was supposed to do it. And if God wants something to be done, it will be done. You don't want to offend him by refusing to do his work." These murders are shocking for a host of reasons, but no aspect of the crimes is more disturbing than Lafferty's complete and determined absence of remorse. How could an apparently sane, avowedly pious man kill a blameless woman and her baby so viciously without the barest flicker of emotion? Whence did he derive the moral justification? What filled him with such certitude? Any attempt to answer such questions must plumb those murky sectors of the heart and head that prompt most of us to believe in God, and compel an impassioned few, predictably, to carry that irrational belief to its logical end. There is a dark side to religious devotion that is too often ignored or denied. As a means of motivating people to be cruel or inhumane, as a means of inciting evil, to borrow the vocabulary of the devout, there may be no more potent force than religion. When the subject of religiously inspired bloodshed comes up, many Americans immediately think of Islamic fundamentalism, which is to be expected in the wake of the September 11th attacks on New York and Washington. But men have been committing heinous acts in the name of God ever since mankind began believing in deities, and extremists exist within all religions. Muhammad is not the only prophet whose words have been used to sanction barbarism. History has not lacked for Christians, Jews, Hindus, Sikhs, and even Buddhists who have been motivated by scripture to butcher innocents. Plenty of these religious extremists have been homegrown, corn-fed Americans. Faith-based violence was present long before Osama bin Laden, and it will be with us long after his demise. Religious zealots like bin Laden, David Koresh, Jim Jones, Shoko Asahara, and Dan Lafferty are common to every age, just as zealots of other stripes are. In any human endeavor, some fraction of its practitioners will be motivated to pursue that activity with such concentrated focus and unalloyed passion that it will consume them utterly. One has to look no further than individuals who feel compelled to devote their lives to becoming concert pianists, say, or climbing Mount Everest. For some, the province of the extreme holds an allure that's irresistible, and a certain percentage of such fanatics will inevitably fixate on matters of the spirit. The zealot may be outwardly motivated by the anticipation of a great reward at the other end. Wealth, fame, eternal salvation. But the real recompense is probably the obsession itself. This is no less true for the religious fanatic than for the fanatical pianist or fanatical mountain climber. As a result of his or her infatuation, existence overflows with purpose. Ambiguity vanishes from the fanatic's worldview. A narcissistic sense of self-assurance displaces all doubt. A delicious rage quickens his pulse, fueled by the sins and shortcomings of lesser mortals who are soiling the world wherever he looks. His perspective narrows until the last remnants of proportion are shed from his life. Through immoderation, he experiences something akin to rapture. Although the far territory of the extreme can exert an intoxicating pull on susceptible individuals of all bents, extremism seems to be especially prevalent among those inclined by temperament or upbringing toward religious pursuits. Faith is the very antithesis of reason, injudiciousness a crucial component of spiritual devotion. And when religious fanaticism supplants ratiocination, all bets are suddenly off. Anything can happen. Absolutely anything. Common sense is no match for the voice of God, as the actions of Dan Lafferty vividly attest. It is the aim of this book to cast some light on Lafferty and his ilk. If trying to understand such people is a daunting exercise, it also seems a useful one, for what it may tell us about the roots of brutality, perhaps, but even more for what might be learned about the nature of faith. Part 1. The schisms that shattered Mormonism time and again, more critical than inroads from without, only attest its strength. They were signs of the seriousness with which converts and dissenters took their salvation, ready to stake their souls on points of doctrine which a later, less biblical generation could treat with indifference. William Mulder and A. Russell Mortensen, Among the Mormons. Chapter 1. The City of the Saints. For thou art an holy people unto the Lord thy God, and the Lord hath chosen thee to be a peculiar people unto himself, above all the nations that are upon the earth. Deuteronomy chapter 14, verse 2. And it shall come to pass that I, the Lord God, will send one mighty and strong, holding the scepter of power in his hand, clothed with light for a covering, whose mouth shall utter words, eternal words, while his bowels shall be a fountain of truth to set in order the house of God. The Doctrine and Covenants, Section 85, revealed to Joseph Smith on November 27, 1832. Balanced atop the highest spire of the Salt Lake Temple, gleaming in the Utah sun, a statue of the angel Moroni stands watch over downtown Salt Lake City with his golden trumpet raised. This massive granite edifice is the spiritual and temporal nexus of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, LDS, which presents itself as the world's only true religion. Temple Square is to Mormons what the Vatican is to Catholics, or the Kaaba in Mecca is to Muslims. At last count, there were more than 11 million saints the world over, and Mormonism is the fastest-growing faith in the Western Hemisphere. At present in the United States, there are more Mormons than Presbyterians or Episcopalians. On the planet as a whole, there are now more Mormons than Jews. Mormonism is considered in some sober academic circles to be well on its way to becoming a major world religion, the first such faith to emerge since Islam. Next door to the temple, the 325 voices of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir swell to fill the tabernacle's vast interior with the robust, haunting chords of Battle Hymn of the Republic, the ensemble's trademark song. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. To much of the world, this choir and its impeccably rendered harmonies are emblematic of the Mormons as a people. Chaste, optimistic, outgoing, dutiful. When Dan Lafferty quotes Mormon scripture to justify murder, the juxtaposition is so incongruous as to seem surreal. The affairs of Mormondom are directed by a cadre of elderly white males in dark suits who carry out their holy duties from a 26-story office tower beside Temple Square. Control of the LDS Church resides in the hands of 15 men. At the top of the hierarchical pyramid is the president, prophet, seer, and revelator, who is believed to be God's direct mouthpiece on earth. The LDS president appoints two trusted apostles to serve as his first counselor and second counselor. Collectively, these three men function as the first presidency. Immediately below the first presidency is the quorum of the 12 apostles, and together these 15 men, they are always men, women are excluded from positions of authority in the Mormon Church, hold sway over the institution and its membership with absolute power. All 15 men serve for life. At the time of the president's death, a quorum of the 12 appoints as new president the apostle from their ranks who has served the longest, hence the exceedingly advanced age of most Mormon presidents. To a man, the LDS leadership adamantly insists that Lafferty should under no circumstances be considered a Mormon. The faith that moved Lafferty to slay his niece and sister-in-law is a brand of religion known as Mormon fundamentalism. LDS church authorities bristle visibly when Mormons and Mormon fundamentalists are even mentioned in the same breath. As Gordon B. Hinckley, the then 88-year-old LDS president and prophet, emphasized during a 1998 television interview on Larry King Live, they have no connection with us whatever. They don't belong to the church. There are actually no Mormon fundamentalists. Nevertheless, Mormons and those who call themselves Mormon fundamentalists, or FLDS, believe in the same holy texts and the same sacred history. Both believe that Joseph Smith, who founded Mormonism in 1830, played a vital role in God's plan for mankind. Both LDS and FLDS consider him to be a prophet comparable in stature to Moses and Isaiah. Mormons and Mormon fundamentalists are each convinced that God regards them and them alone as his favored children, a peculiar treasure unto me above all people. But if both proudly refer to themselves as the Lord's chosen, they diverge on one especially inflammatory point of religious doctrine. Unlike their present-day Mormon compatriots, Mormon fundamentalists passionately believe that saints have a divine obligation to take multiple wives. Followers of the FLDS faith engage in polygamy, they explain, as a matter of religious duty. There are more than 30,000 FLDS polygamists living in Canada, Mexico, and throughout the American West. Some experts estimate there may be as many as 100,000. Even this larger number amounts to less than 1% of the membership in the LDS Church worldwide, but all the same, leaders of the mainstream church are extremely discomforted by these legions of polygamous brethren. Mormon authorities treat the fundamentalists as they would a crazy uncle. They try to keep the polygs hidden in the attic, safely out of sight, but the fundamentalists always seem to be sneaking out to appear in public at inopportune moments to create unsavory scenes, embarrassing the entire LDS clan. The LDS Church happens to be exceedingly prickly about its short, uncommonly rich history, and no aspect of that history makes the Church more defensive than plural marriage. The LDS leadership has worked very hard to persuade both the modern church membership and the American public that polygamy was a quaint, long-abandoned idiosyncrasy practiced by a mere handful of 19th-century Mormons. The religious literature handed out by the earnest young missionaries in Temple Square makes no mention of the fact that Joseph Smith, still the religion's focal personage, married at least 33 women, and probably as many as 48. Nor does it mention that the youngest of these wives was just 14 years old when Joseph explained to her that God had commanded that she marry him or face eternal damnation. Polygamy was, in fact, one of the most sacred credos of Joseph's church, a tenet important enough to be canonized for the ages as Section 132 of the Doctrine and Covenants, one of Mormonism's primary scriptural texts. Mormons esteem three books of Scripture above all others, the Book of Mormon, the Doctrine and Covenants, often referred to simply as D&C, and the Pearl of Great Price. The revered prophet described plural marriage as part of the most holy and important doctrine ever revealed to man on earth, and taught that a man needed at least three wives to attain the fullness of exaltation in the afterlife. He warned that God had explicitly commanded that all those who have this law revealed unto them must obey the same. And if ye abide not that covenant, then are ye damned. For no one can reject this covenant and be permitted to enter into my glory. Joseph was murdered in Illinois by a mob of Mormon haters in 1844. Brigham Young assumed leadership of the church and led the saints to the barren wilds of the Great Basin, where in short order they established a remarkable empire and unabashedly embraced the covenant of spiritual wifery. This both titillated and shocked the sensibilities of Victorian-era Americans, who tended to regard polygamy as a brutish practice on a par with slavery. It's likely that in the 19th century polygamy was actually abhorrent to many more Americans than slavery was. The latter, after all, had a multitude of proponents in numerous states, whereas it was hard to find many advocates for the former outside Utah Territory. In 1856, recognizing the strength of the anti-polygamy vote, Republican candidate John C. Fremont ran for president on a platform that pledged to prohibit in the territories those twin relics of barbarism, polygamy and slavery. Fremont lost the election, but a year later the man who did win, President James Buchanan, sent the U.S. Army to invade Utah, dismantle Brigham Young's theocracy, and eradicate polygamy. The so-called Utah War, however, neither removed Brigham from power nor ended the doctrine of plural marriage, to the annoyance and bafflement of a whole series of American presidents. An escalating sequence of judicial and legislative challenges to polygamy ensued, culminating in the Edmunds-Tucker Act of 1887, which disincorporated the LDS Church and forfeited to the federal government all church property worth more than $50,000. With their feet held fast to the fire, the saints ultimately had no choice but to renounce polygamy. But even as LDS leaders publicly claimed in 1890 to have relinquished the practice, they quietly dispatched bands of Mormons to establish polygamous colonies in Mexico and Canada, and some of the highest-ranking LDS authorities secretly continued to take multiple wives and perform plural marriages well into the 20th century. Although LDS leaders were initially loath to abandon plural marriage, eventually they adopted a more pragmatic approach to American politics, emphatically rejected the practice and actually began urging government agencies to prosecute polygamists. It was this single change in ecclesiastical policy, more than anything else, that transformed the LDS Church into its astonishingly successful present-day iteration. Having jettisoned polygamy, Mormons gradually ceased to be regarded as a crackpot sect. The LDS Church acquired the trappings of a conventional faith so successfully that it is now widely considered to be the quintessential American religion. Mormon fundamentalists, however, believe that acceptance into the American mainstream came at way too high a price. They contend that the Mormon leaders made an unforgivable compromise by capitulating to the U.S. government on polygamy over a century ago. They insist that the church sold them out, that the LDS leadership abandoned one of the religion's most crucial theological tenets for the sake of political expediency. These present-day polygamists therefore consider themselves to be the keepers of the flame, the only true and righteous Mormons. In forsaking Section 132, the sacred principle of plural marriage, the LDS Church has gone badly astray, they warn. Fundamentalist prophets bellow from their pulpits that the modern church has become the wickedest whore of all the earth. Mormon fundamentalists probably cite Section 132 of the Doctrine and Covenants more than any other piece of LDS scripture. Their second most popular citation is likely Section 85, in which it was revealed to Joseph that I, the Lord God, will send one mighty and strong to set in order the house of God. Many fundamentalists are convinced that the one mighty and strong is already here on earth among them, holding the scepter of power in his hand, and that very soon now he will lead the Mormon church back onto the right path and restore Joseph's most holy and important doctrine. Chapter 2. Short Creek. Extreme and bizarre religious ideas are so commonplace in American history that it is difficult to speak of them as fringe at all. To speak of a fringe implies a mainstream, but in terms of numbers, perhaps the largest component of the religious spectrum in contemporary America remains what it has been since colonial times, a fundamentalist evangelicalism with powerful millenarian strands. The doomsday theme has never been far from the center of American religious thought. The nation has always had believers who responded to this threat by a determination to flee from the wrath to come, to separate themselves from the city of destruction, even if that meant putting themselves at odds with the law and with their communities or families. We can, throughout American history, find select and separatist groups who looked to a prophetic individual claiming divine revelation in a setting that repudiated conventional assumptions about property, family life, and sexuality. They were marginal groups, peculiar people, people set apart from the world, the Shakers and the Ephrata community, the communes of Oneida and Amana, the followers of Joseph Smith and Brigham Young. Philip Jenkins, Mystics and Messiahs. Snaking diagonally across the top of Arizona, the Grand Canyon is a stupendous 277-mile rent in the planet's hide that functions as a formidable natural barrier, effectively cutting off the northwestern corner from the rest of the state. This isolated wedge of backcountry, almost as big as New Jersey, yet traversed by a single paved highway, is known as the Arizona Strip, and it has one of the lowest population densities in the 48 conterminous states. There is, however, one relatively large municipality here. Colorado City, home to some 9,000 souls, is more than five times as populous as any other town in the district. Motorists driving west on Highway 389 across the parched barrens of the Uinkaret Plateau are apt to be surprised when 28 miles past Fredonia, population 1,036, the second largest town on the strip, Colorado City suddenly materializes in the middle of nowhere. A sprawl of small businesses and unusually large homes squatting beneath a towering escarpment of vermilion sandstone called Canaan Mountain. All but a handful of the town's residents are Mormon fundamentalists. They live in this patch of desert in the hope of being left alone to follow the sacred principle of plural marriage without interference from government authorities or the LDS Church. Straddling the Utah-Arizona border, Colorado City is home to at least three Mormon fundamentalist sects, including the world's largest, the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. More commonly known as the United Effort Plan, or UEP, it requires its members live in strict accordance with the commandments of a frail 92-year-old tax accountant turned prophet named Rulon T. Jeffs. The part of town lying on the Arizona side of the line is officially called Colorado City, and the portion on the Utah side is officially named Hilldale, although old-timers ignore both appellations, preferring to call it Short Creek, which was the town's name until 1962, when it was legally incorporated and renamed. The United Effort Plan is the legal name of the financial trust that owns all the church's assets, including virtually all the land in town. Uncle Rulon, as he is known to his followers, traces his divinely ordained leadership in an unbroken chain that leads directly back to Joseph Smith himself. Although his feeble bearing would seem to make him poorly cast for the role, the residents of Colorado City believe that Uncle Rulon is the one mighty and strong whose coming was prophesied by Joseph in 1832. "A lot of people here are convinced Uncle Rulon is going to live forever," says Deloy Bateman, a 48-year-old science teacher at Colorado City High School. Not only was Deloy born and raised in this faith, but his forebears were some of the religion's most illustrious figures. His great-grandfather and great-great-grandfather were among the 13 founding members of the Mormon Fundamentalist Church, and his adoptive grandfather, Leroy Johnson, was the prophet who immediately preceded Uncle Rulon as the leader of Colorado City. At the moment, Deloy is driving his third-hand Chevy van on a dirt road on the outskirts of town. One of his two wives and eight of his 17 children are riding in the back. Suddenly, he hits the brakes and the van lurches to a stop on the shoulder. "Now there's an interesting sight," Deloy declares, sizing up the wreckage of a television satellite dish behind some sagebrush off the side of the road. "Looks like somebody had to get rid of their television, hauled it out of town and dumped it." Members of the religion, he explains, are forbidden to watch television or read magazines or newspapers. The temptations of the outside world loom large, however, and some members of the faith inevitably succumb. "As soon as you ban something," Deloy observes, "you make it incredibly attractive. People will sneak into St. George or Cedar City and buy themselves a dish, put it up where it can't easily be seen, and secretly watch TV during every free moment. Then one Sunday, Uncle Rulon will give one of his sermons about the evils of television. He'll announce that he knows exactly who has one, and warn that everyone who does is putting their eternal souls in serious jeopardy. Every time he does that, a bunch of satellite dishes immediately get dumped in the desert like this one here. For 2 or 3 years afterward, there won't be any televisions in town, but then gradually the dishes start secretly going up again until the next crackdown. People try to do the right thing, but they're only human." As the TV prohibition suggests, life in Colorado City under Rulon Jeffs bears more than a passing resemblance to life in Kabul under the Taliban. Uncle Rulon's word carries the weight of law. The mayor and every other city employee answers to him, as do the entire police force and the superintendent of public schools. Even animals are subject to his whim. 2 years ago, a Rottweiler killed a child in town. An edict went out that dogs would no longer be allowed within the city limits. A posse of young men was dispatched to round up all the canines, after which the unsuspecting pets were taken into a dry wash and shot. Uncle Rulon has married an estimated 75 women, with whom he has fathered at least 65 children. Several of his wives were given to him in marriage when they were 14 or 15, and he was in his 80s. His sermons frequently stress the need for total submission. "I want to tell you that the greatest freedom you can enjoy is in obedience," he has preached. "Perfect obedience produces perfect faith." Like most FLDS prophets, his teachings rely heavily on fiery screeds penned in the 19th century by Joseph Smith and Brigham Young. Uncle Rulon likes to remind his followers of Brigham's warning that for those who commit such unspeakable sins as homosexuality or having sexual intercourse with a member of the African race, The penalty under the law of God is death on the spot. This will always be so. Polygamy is illegal in both Utah and Arizona. To avoid prosecution, typically men in Colorado City will legally marry only the first of their wives. Subsequent wives, although spiritually married to their husband by Uncle Rulon, thus remain single mothers in the eyes of the state. This has the added benefit of allowing the enormous families in town to qualify for welfare and other forms of public assistance. Despite the fact that Uncle Rulon and his followers regard the governments of Arizona, Utah, and the United States as satanic forces out to destroy the UEP, their polygamous community receives more than $6 million a year in public funds. More than $4 million of government largesse flows each year into the Colorado City Public School District, which, according to the Phoenix New Times, is operated primarily for the financial benefit of the FLDS Church and for the personal enrichment of FLDS school district leaders. Reporter John Doherty determined that school administrators have plundered the district's treasury by running up thousands of dollars in personal expenses on district credit cards, purchasing expensive vehicles for their personal use, and engaging in extensive travel. The spending spree culminated in December 2000, when the district purchased a $220,000 Cessna 210 airplane to facilitate trips by district personnel to cities across Arizona. Colorado City has received $1.9 million from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development to pave its streets, improve the fire department, and upgrade the water system. Immediately south of the city limits, the federal government built a $2.8 million airport that serves almost no one beyond the fundamentalist community. 33% of the town's residents receive food stamps, compared to the state average of 4.7%. Currently, the residents of Colorado City receive $8 in government services for every dollar they pay in taxes. By comparison, residents in the rest of Mojave County, Arizona, receive just over a dollar in services per tax dollar paid. Uncle Rulon justifies all that assistance from the wicked government by explaining that really the money is coming from the Lord, says Deloy Bateman. We're taught that it's the Lord's way of manipulating the system to take care of his chosen people. Fundamentalists call defrauding the government bleeding the beast and regard it as a virtuous act. Uncle Rulon and his followers believe that the earth is 7,000 years old and that men have never walked on the moon. Film clips showing Apollo astronauts on the lunar surface are part of an elaborate hoax foisted on the world by the American government, they say. In addition to the edict against watching television or reading newspapers, residents of Colorado City are forbidden to have any contact with people outside the UEP, including family members who have left the religion. Deloy, as it happens, is one such apostate. Deloy and his immense family live in a correspondingly immense house. At 16,000 square feet, it is more than five times as large as a typical three-bedroom home, which he built with his own hands in the middle of town. Deloy's brother David lives in a similarly large home just a few yards away on the other side of a six-foot fence. My brother over the fence there, says Deloy, gesturing with his chin. Him and I are just as close as any two people on the planet. Our father was disabled when we were small children, so David and I raised each other. But now he isn't allowed to talk to me because I'm no longer in the religion. If his wife catches him having a conversation with me, she'll take all the children, and Uncle Rulon will marry her to some other man within hours. And David will be what the locals call a eunuch, a man who was allowed to remain in the religion but who has had his family taken from him, like what was supposed to happen to me when I left the work. Deloy used to be a respected member of the religion. He has never touched a drop of alcohol or coffee, never smoked a cigarette, never uttered a profane word. He was unwavering in his obedience and made a point to keep his head down. Then in 1996, relatives of his second wife began spreading scurrilous rumors about him. Somebody shared these rumors with the prophet, and the upshot, Deloy laments, was that Uncle Rulon called me into his office and made all kinds of accusations against me. The prophet, Deloy says, was extremely angry. So angry he was actually vibrating and spittle was flying out of his mouth as he spoke. The normal procedure when the prophet confronts you like that is to basically say, I'm sorry I've done this to displease thee. What would thou have me do? But this time I couldn't bring myself to do it. I just couldn't say it. There was simply no truth in what he had accused me of doing. So I leaned over until my face was within inches of his, and then, real calmly, in a soft voice, I said, Uncle Rulon, everything you have said is a lie, an absolute lie. And he just sat back in his chair in total shock. This was not something anyone had ever done. Upon arriving home, Deloy considered the enormity of what had just occurred. Uncle Rulon spoke to God on a continual basis. All his wisdom and knowledge supposedly came straight from the Lord. But in a matter of moments, it had become apparent to me that this man wasn't really communicating with God, or he would have known that what he accused me of was a lie. Right then and there, I decided to leave the work, even though I knew it would mean the end of my life as I knew it. When Deloy failed to show up for the weekly priesthood meeting on the following Sunday, within 24 hours Uncle Rulon dispatched someone to Deloy's house to take away his wives and children. According to UEP dogma, wives do not belong to their husbands, nor do children belong to their parents. All are property of the priesthood and may be claimed at any time. Uncle Rulon decreed that Deloy's wives and progeny were to be given to another, worthier man immediately. But both of Deloy's wives declined to leave him. Uncle Rulon was flabbergasted. The priesthood means far more than family or anything else, explains Deloy. For my wives to defy Uncle Rulon and stick with me, even though I was going straight to hell, that was unheard of. Deloy's spouses and all his children except the three oldest thus became apostates too. In Colorado City, the faithful are taught that apostates are more wicked than Gentiles, or even mainline Mormons. In the unique lexicon shared by Mormons and Mormon fundamentalists, all those who have never subscribed to the teachings of Joseph Smith are known as Gentiles, e.g., among Mormons, even Jews are referred to as Gentiles. Those who were once devout but have left the faith are apostates. Non-practicing saints are Jack Mormons. In a sermon preached on July 16, 2000, Bishop Warren Jeffs, Uncle Rulon's son and heir apparent, emphasized that an apostate is the most dark person on earth. Apostates, he explained, have turned traitor on the priesthood and their own existence, and they are led about by their master, Lucifer. Apostates are literally tools of the devil. When Deloy apostatized, relatives who remained in the religion were forbidden to speak to him, his wives, or his apostate children ever again. And although Deloy had built and paid for his home, the UEP owns all the land within the city limits, including the lot on which Deloy's house was built. Uncle Rulon and the UEP have filed a legal action to take possession of Deloy's house and are currently trying to evict him from Colorado City. It is no accident that Colorado City is a long way from anywhere. Short Creek, as the town was then known, was settled in the 1920s by a half-dozen fundamentalist families wanting to live where they would be free to follow Joseph Smith's most holy principle without outside interference. The UEP failed to appreciate the extent to which polygamy has periodically stirred public passions, however. By the early 1950s, the population of Short Creek had grown to more than 400. This so alarmed government officials and the LDS leadership in Salt Lake City that Arizona Governor Howard Pyle, with church encouragement and financial backing, concocted an elaborate plan to raid the town and stamp out polygamy. Governor Pyle said about the raid, "We didn't make a single move that we didn't clear with the Council of Twelve, the quorum of the 12 apostles which runs the LDS church. They were 1,000% cooperative, 100% behind it." On July 26, 1953, 8 months before Deloy Bateman was born, some 100 state police officers, 40 county deputies, and dozens of troops from the Arizona National Guard drove into Short Creek in the pre-dawn darkness and arrested 122 polygamous men and women, including Deloy's father. The 263 children from these families were declared wards of the state, bused 400 miles to Kingman, Arizona, and placed in foster care. In a carefully worded, multi-page statement defending the raid, Governor Pyle called it a momentous police action against insurrection within Arizona's own borders. He explained, "The leaders of this mass violation of so many of our laws have boasted directly to Mojave County officers that they